You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Looks like we'll know by the end of the week who President Trump is nominating to fill the seat held by U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She died on Friday at the age of 87. President Trump called into Fox News this morning and was asked about the timeline for Ginsburg's replacement.
We want to pay respect. We will have probably services on Thursday or Friday, as I understand it. I think, you know, the respect, we should wait till the services are over for Justice Ginsburg. And so we're looking probably at Friday or maybe Saturday.
Ginsburg's death came 46 days before Election Day. Friday evening, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell vowed to move forward on the confirmation process. Democrats, even a couple of Republican senators, say it should be put on hold until after the elections. We want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Should President Trump and the GOP Senate work quickly to get a new justice confirmed? Or is this a job for the next president and Senate, whoever they may be? How would you describe Ruth Bader Ginsburg's legacy? What questions do you have about Supreme Court nominations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, good to have you back with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, Charlie, first of all, your reaction to the passing of Justice Ginsburg?
I mean, it's going to leave a hole in the court in many ways. I mean, she brought a breadth of experience, both from her personal life and some of the private practice that she did, but then all the years that she has spent on courts at the federal level. I mean, she was nominated to the circuit court at the District of Columbia in 1980. Jimmy Carter nominated her. And so, you know, she served 40 years at the federal level. And, you know, she brought a unique voice, in particular for equal rights for women. And again, that was from her private practice, but also from her legal experience on the bench. So it's going to be interesting whether or not others on the bench take up that slack and sort of take up her clarion call for those kinds of rights, or whether her replacement will do that for her.
Can you talk a little more about what you think she'll be most remembered for?
It's interesting that I think for me, because I teach constitutional law to my students, you know, she had such a large impact on shaping the way the American courts today think about the equality of women. Many don't know that out of law school, one of her first important pieces of work that she did was with the ACLU, and she helped to shape the doctrine that is used by the court now and how it evaluates whether or not women are treated unequally under law. And so these cases from the early 1970s, in particular one called Craig v. Boren, where we see the court develop this very particular test to evaluate whether or not the law is treating women in a disadvantageous way. I mean, her fingerprints are just all over that doctrine, and in several cases that preceded that. And of course, she pursued that much more on the court. I mean, I think sometimes when we think about women's issues, we often get stuck thinking about abortion, which of course is not an unimportant argument to have. But certainly when we think about something like the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which is about pay disparities and the way in which women could bring suit if they thought that they were being treated differently by employers. I mean, that too, that federal act was promoted in large part because of a dissent that she wrote in a case about the lack of opportunity women had to bring lawsuits of that type. Look, she had a broad career, and she does have a lot of impact in a lot of areas, but I think that is one that's central to her legacy.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College in De Pere, looking at the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And now we turn to some of the politics that will follow. Let's start with a caller. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon. So I think that if we're going to have one set of rules that applies equally and fairly to everyone, I kind of feel like we should not fill the Supreme Court position until after the election, because that was the precedent that was just established with the last go around of a vacancy.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. And there it is, Charlie. Marcus diving right into the question of when this should go forward, and should the standard established by Republicans in 2016, 8 months before an election, apply again this time a month and a half out from an election?
I mean, obviously, from a consistency point of view, you would expect the Republicans, who made a very vocal case to be able to fill the vacancy created by the death of Antonin Scalia, you would expect that they would pump the brakes and we wouldn't see them rushing headlong into this. especially since we're 6 weeks out from an election. And the case that they made previously was, you know, the people should be speaking on this issue by whom they elect. But also remember that Article 3 of the Constitution leaves a lot of autonomy to the Congress to decide how they're going to manage the court, how many members, what their qualifications are, and how they're going to vet them to see whether or not they're appropriate for the bench. So quite honestly, if the Republicans decide to change their mind, there's nothing impeding them except for the reaction of the public and whether or not they're going to vote Republicans back in office in the Senate to keep changing their mind like this. So, I mean, Marcus wants consistency, and I think that makes sense, but there's no roadblock here. And so if this is what administration and the Republicans in the Senate want to try to pursue, it is sort of within their constitutional priorities to do that.
Is there an electoral penalty to pay, Charlie, especially with somebody like Senator Lindsey Graham, who said as late as October of 2018, if an opening comes in the last year of President Trump's term, the primary process has started, we'll wait to the next election. And Graham had previously said, use my words against me back in 2016. He's up for election. Can these words effectively be used against a candidate in a situation like this?
I mean, the polls right now have him, you know, in a state where he should win. I mean, I think he's facing one of the, you know, best challenges he's had in a while, and that may motivate individuals. But remember, it is a reddish state, South Carolina, and as a result, people might be very happy that he changes his mind and confirms another justice to the court and doesn't mind that inconsistency, because the outcome, a court that tends conservative and might produce doctrine that is accepted by voters of this type, is actually welcomed. And so it might actually boost his chances for reelection if he decides to go down this path. I think it depends on the state. I think it depends upon whether or not a challenger is close to an individual. I mean, someone like Susan Collins, she's kind of in a pickle here because she is running for her life. And so I'm not sure whether or not Mitch McConnell is going to get her vote, because she has been roundly criticized by the way that she has behaved over the last two nominations to the court. And this one may seal her fate if she decides to vote with McConnell and with Trump for a new nominee to the bench.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us in La Crosse. Tom, hi. Oop, do we have you, Tom? I'm saying no. Let's try Jamie with us in Portage then. Jamie, hi.
Hello. You guys have hit on most everything that I was going to say already, but I actually had two other quick things. First, one of the conversations I heard over the weekend was court reform, and I had a conversation with a former teacher of mine, and she said that we should limit justices to 18 years or to the age of 65, whichever comes first. And the second thing is, if the person could comment on her dissenting opinions and how important those have been and how important they will be in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie. Two big questions there. Let's start with this idea, and we've talked to guests who have a movement to try to have that. There are different term limit suggested 13 or 18 years. But that idea, Charlie, that we have kind of this absurd situation where if I'm a Supreme Court justice, I might want to stay. I can't retire if I'm worried about the future makeup of the court.
I mean, this is something that would take a constitutional amendment, and constitutional amendments are challenging, and they are particularly challenging in our polarized political world of the moment. Remember that it takes 2/3 of each chamber of Congress and then 3/4 of the states to ratify any amendment to the Constitution. And of course, depending on who's in power at any given moment, is going to create a different ox getting gored. And because of that, you almost never get consensus for what might be perceived by most of the public as a rational change that would help to diffuse some of the controversies that erupt at times like this. And so it would take a monumental effort by the public to do this, to really put pressure on elected officials, because Democrats aren't going to want to do it when they have the power to nominate, and neither are Republicans when they have the power. The other issue, one he mentioned about automatic retirement by 65, and think about somebody like Ginsburg. She was 60 when she was nominated to the court. That gives her half of a decade to influence the law and to add her voice, you know, to the conversation about what doctrine is going to be over time. So, you know, we might be placing people who haven't seasoned over time and become eminently qualified for the high court. I mean, we have had some very good justices, including some that are sitting on the bench right now, who are well over the age of 65, who can still contribute their intellectual prowess to those kinds of decisions. There are issues with this. So issues that I think we'd have to the process of amending the Constitution.
Jamie also asked about your thoughts on Justice Ginsburg's dissents and how influential they might be.
I mean, dissents are often sort of ticking time bombs because they exist as sort of a written justification for alternative approaches to understanding the law and alternatives to decisions by majorities, even significant majorities, you know, 7 or 8 justices on the bench. And I think one of the most famous, of course, is from Plessy versus Ferguson. And in that case, you know, they were making an argument for a colorblind constitution that pivoted in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education and became the law of the land. That's what's going to be the legacy of her dissenting opinions. She was forceful. She pulled no punches. She didn't really care who she's going to offend among her colleagues because she considered the battle over the law segmented from the friendship she had. So she pulled no punches and she did not care what people thought about her opinions. And so she has got this sort of well of legal interpretation that's going to serve generations in the future.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Charlie, people are suggesting this shakes up the election campaign. Does it? I mean, people who are thinking about the Supreme Court were already thinking about it. Does this emerge as a bigger issue now? Does it crowd out COVID-19 and the other big issues, the long list of big issues that are already out there?
I mean, I think it may, and I think it depends on what exactly the Trump administration decides to do. I mean, there is a strategic case to be made to not make the nomination because that will drive turnout from the base. His argument being, well, if I'm handcuffed and I can't make the nomination until after I'm reelected, then reelect me. I mean, if he's got some soft spots among his base and they're not going to show up and vote for him, this may juice the process in a way where he actually gets a high turnout that gets him over the edge in battleground states like Wisconsin.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We talked about the legacy of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the debate over her potential successor. We'll talk about that more in the weeks to come. Lots of callers who didn't get on, but we'll give you more shots at that for sure.